I'm with Phil Howell at the NIAB greenhouses, and all around me are completely out of season wheat growing at various stages of maturity. Phil, can I ask you a couple of quick questions about this? Because it seems quite strange that we're in the middle of winter, and yet I look like I'm on a summer's day here. What's happening?
Well, what we try and do with some of our breeding work is squeeze as many generations in as quickly as we can. Typically, funding only lasts for 3 years. We want to get as much of the project done as possible. So by using this facility, we have a cold room where we can give plants, we can fool them into thinking it's winter time at any time of the year. And then this greenhouse is very bright. We've got sodium lights. We run in those for 16 hours a day. So it's fooling the plants into thinking it's the middle of summer. So that way we can easily squeeze two generations a year, sometimes three generations a year through the greenhouse.
So can you explain what project you've been doing here?
We're part of a big project called WISP, which stands for the Wheat Improvement Strategic Programme. It's funded by the BBSRC, so one of the government research councils, and it's bringing together different groups working on wheat, and our particular interest here is by exploiting some of the genetic diversity of some of wheat's close relatives. So we're looking at some of the, we call them tetraploid wheats, so species like Durum, which is pasta wheat, cultivated emmer, wild emmer, and rivet wheat. And we're also recreating the event that led to bread wheat, which happened in the wild 10,000 years ago. And that allows us to access a whole set of diversity from another grass species that gives wheat a third of its genes, which is called wild goat grass.
Do you have any wild goat grass here? Can I see?
I can't see any, but if you come back another time, we might be able to find you some.
The wild goat grass I'm looking at, I'm looking at something over there. It's very, very tall. Some of these are very, very tall,
yes,
aren't
yeah.
they? They're abnormally tall.
Yeah.
I'm assuming something like wild goat grass would have been very tall.
It's not, actually. It's... If we were to imagine these plants, so these are just some seedlings at about the four-leaf stage. If these were wild goat grass, then it wouldn't get much taller than this. So this is, 8 inches tall? But it would be a huge tussock. And as wild goat grass comes to maturity, if you were then to pick the pot up, you'd find all of the seeds are dropped on the floor. It shatters. It's a really good weed. So that's one of the things we're trying to get rid of. We don't want that in bread wheat because a farmer will come to harvest the crop and it's already on the floor. So there are good things that come from these wild relatives, but there are also some bad things that we have to breed out.
We're talking about breeding effectively old varieties of wheat. You were talking to me a bit earlier about landraces.
Yeah, that's another group who are part of this WISP project. So the John Innes Centre in Norwich have this fantastic collection of landraces. Now, landraces are what farmers grew before plant breeding was sort of formalised. So in the early part of the 20th century, plant breeding became systematic and scientific. But before that, farmers grew landraces. And typically, they're quite locally adapted mixed populations that might not be the highest yielding, but they're very well adapted to the place in which they're grown. And typically they will change slightly from year to year depending on what the season has thrown at them.
In terms of these varieties, then, you're dealing with varieties here that are 10,000 years old and 120, 130 years old.
Yes, I would say so, yeah. It's diversity that hasn't really been explored in modern varieties. Yeah.
So why the need for it? I pick a loaf of bread up. Bread is just bread, isn't it? Why the need?
Breeders are telling us that there is a very tight and narrow gene pool. And they're after new sources of diversity. If we become too reliant on the same material all the time, then we see it all the time. Pests and diseases are constantly evolving, and something that's resistant now, the pest will evolve. It's like the flu virus. It will constantly evolve and overcome the resistance. So they're looking for new sources of resistance all the time. We're also, most people agree, going through climate change. So we're looking for new solutions. If the UK has hotter, drier summers and wetter winters, we might not be well adapted to that. So we need new sources of variation that will help the plant to cope with those stresses.
Do you mimic those conditions in here? So do you kind of like wet the roots and give it a bit of a drier to see which ones pull through?
We're not in particular, but certainly other researchers are doing that sort of thing, yes.
So what happened that narrowed the gene pool so significantly, and when did that happen?
The first time what we would recognise as wheat is thought to have existed was around about 10,000 years ago, when one of the progenitors, which is still found today, and that's Emma wheat, it made a natural hybrid with something called wild goat grass. So a tusky grass that's still found. It's native to around the Caspian Sea. So when that happened, we think it only happened a handful of times. So already that's a massive bottleneck. So there's far more variation in the goat grasses than there is in breadwheat. A lot of that will be useless, but there will be some gems in there, and it's those gems that we want to try and capture. So that's what happened. That was our baseline 10,000 years ago. Then through, first of all, domestication by early farmers, 10,000 years ago and onwards, and then through formal plant breeding, it's a constant series of selecting the best. You keep the best and you throw the rest away. You keep the best, you throw the rest away. And that inevitably is some of what you throw away will actually turn out to have been useful.
So if we just have a look here, and I mean, there's some amazing, there are pots and pots of wheat on here, and looking at this one here, what are you looking at? I'm looking at just some wheat that looks as though it's sort of in mid-June, and yet I'm standing here in mid-January.
Exactly, yeah.
What are you looking for?
At this stage, I mean, it's hard to see. You can't always tell in a greenhouse if something is good or not. Normally we go to the field to do that. So,
right. But if we were in the field, what would you be looking for?
I'd be looking for how long the year is, how many grains it looks like the year will produce. So you can make...
So this one here?
This one here is quite a long ear. And if you turn it onto its side, there's not actually that much space between each. We call them the spikelets, these little flowers on the ear. There's not much space between them. They're quite compact, quite closely spaced together.
And that's good or bad?
That's good for yield, because it means you're getting more grains off each ear. And then we also look in this direction.
You're turning, you're kind of bending it there, so it's kind of like...
So if we open it up, you can open it up with your fingers like that, and each site here...
Oh, yes.
That would form... You can see it just starting to form there. That's an early stage of grain formation.
That's quite a nice, so plump little green grain in there. That looks nice.
So in this spikelet, we've got one on that side, one on that side, and one in the middle. Now, sometimes we can get two on each side and one in the middle. So you've got five grains instead of three grains at this site. So that's another way you can increase yield. We call it the spikelet fertility. You can increase the numbers of grains on the ear that way. And another way of building more yield is to actually have larger grains. So typically, wheat grains, we measure them with something called 1,000 grain weight. We count out 1,000 grains with a machine, not by hand, and we measure how much that weighs. Typically, wheat is 50 to 55 grams. Some of what we're working with has been over 70 grams. They're these big, big grains.
You obviously have to have big stems to...
That's another issue. So it's all very well having lots of yield, but you've got to be able to harvest that safely. So if you have too much yield without strengthening the straw of the plant, It gets top heavy towards harvest time, and the whole field lodges.
You'll flatten a field, especially if there's a lot of rain or wind or anything.
And that not only makes it harder to harvest, it's more likely that the grain will sprout if you get a thunderstorm or a period of rain, and you completely wipe out any bread-making quality that way, because the starches in the grain then start to turn to sugars. You can't make proper bread.
Right, because they'll effectively get stressed and say, oh, help, we need to stop reproducing.
They'll start germinating, basically.
Right, okay, that makes sense. So here in front of us, describe what we've got here.
In the foreground then, we have some plants which have not long come out of the cold room, so they're still thinking in their heads it's maybe early spring, we'll start to run up to flowering. And then towards the back, next to the window, we've got some that we brought out of the cold room a lot earlier, and they're starting to change colour, they're starting to ripen off a bit now.
And what are these in terms of, you know, who are their parents? What's the...
They're part of what we're doing, so we're recreating that rare crossing event from 10,000 years ago. And then we cross the product of that with modern bread-making varieties to try and move some of the genes that we've incorporated into a modern UK-adapted background.
Okay, in bread-making terms, why is that... I understand that it's stopping and working against climate change and resilience and pests, but as a bread-maker, as somebody who bakes... What does that mean for me? Are you going to get any extra flavour in there is what I'm really wanting to know.
To be honest, we don't know, but I'd be very surprised if we wouldn't. So we have looked at one gene in particular, which controls whether the bread is what the flour is what we call soft milling, which is used for cakes and biscuits, or hard milling, which is what's used for bread and pastry. So it's a very well-known gene, which is why we studied it. It makes it a lot easier.
What's the gene called?
It's called purindoline, but people call it the hardness gene. Because we know a lot about the gene, we know the DNA sequence itself of the gene, and we can look in the goat grasses and in our synthetic wheats to see, do they have the normal copy of the gene, or is it something different? And a high proportion of the times we've looked, we found something completely different. Now, we don't know whether that means it's harder milling or softer milling. We haven't had enough seed to actually do that test yet, but we do know that it's different. That's the only gene we've looked at, and already we found lots of differences.
Now, you see, of course, I immediately want to know who's going to make the first loaf of bread with it. So... there's some considerable height difference going on at the back there. Another factor I'm supposing in your quest to find this sort of, you know, these new breeds?
Yeah, quite often what we find is that the plants, when we do get them out into the field, so we do a couple of years in the greenhouse to bulk them up and sort of stabilise them a bit, and then we go to the field to test them, because that's the best place to test them. Quite often what we see is that they're much more vigorous, that you just kind of get a whole lot more plant. Everything above the ground is more. That doesn't necessarily mean you're getting more grain, but it means that it's somehow better at capturing the carbon dioxide from the air and turning that into plant matter. Of course we want to turn more of that into the grain in the first place, but often we see them, but they're much taller and much more vigorous.
In the greenhouse?
And even more so, it's more exaggerated in the field.
Looking at these, one of the questions I've got is on the nutrient side of things. Mm-hmm. And of course, we were chatting earlier about the fact that a lot of the heritage grains, and I've been learning a lot about these, they've got very deep roots that seek out moisture at much deeper levels. It means that, for example, if they do have a dry spell, they can go further down to fetch the water out. But they also have this mycorrhizal relationship of these little fungus that kind of like they hide out in them, and they have this symbiotic relationship that they kind of bring the nutrients up to the plant gives them sugar. Have I summarised that correctly?
Yeah, they sort of do part of the Roots job for them.
Okay.
Yeah.
So the question I've got to ask you is, in terms of environmental, sustainable crop, is that part of your remit? And are you looking, for example, at grains that perhaps need less traditional fertiliser to grow?
Indirectly, I think we are. So we some of the first lines we've made, we've sent to be tested by researchers at Rothamsted in Hertfordshire. And they've run a series of trials where they've grown them at conventional farm levels of fertiliser and much lower levels of fertiliser. And they've measured the yield and they've measured all sorts of things about the straw and the leaf and so on. And what seems to happen, certainly in some seasons, is that our material yield drops off when you reduce the fertiliser, but not as much as some of the modern varieties. So there's something about them that suggests they're better at scavenging for the nutrients from the soil itself. And we've actually started some trials here where we don't add any fertiliser at all. The only fertiliser they get is what was fixed by the previous crop of beans, of legumes in the crop rotation. And most of them look pretty stressed, but you'll come across the odd plot that looks absolutely brilliant. And for the first time, I just got the results the other week, we've looked at the protein levels in the grain from those. And we have some leading bread-making varieties in as controls, and they were producing around 8 or 9% protein, and some of these lines are producing 14% protein. So they're better able to deal with the little nitrogen that's there and turn that into protein.
That sounds really hopeful. I mean, I'm going to ask more specifically about those proteins. Are they proteins that will translate into a bouncy, lovely loaf? Are they the gliadins of the and are they, because protein doesn't necessarily translate to a good loaf?
No, absolutely. Most of the protein that is stored in the seed of wheat is gliadins, which are kind of sort of neutral. They don't add anything to something being a good bread maker or a bad bread maker, not as much as the glutens. And at the moment, we haven't looked at what class of protein these lines are over-accumulating.
In theory,
yeah,
if you can increase the glutenin and reduce the gliadin, that would, in theory, reduce the allergens to it as well. Is that correct?
Yeah, I mean, from my understanding, the thing that can give people wheat allergies isn't the gluten itself, it's the gliadin. So if we could keep the glutens, which are what give bread its structure, but reduce the gliadins, then not only could we make wheat a bit more palatable and tolerable to these people, we might cut our reliance on fertiliser as well.
You see, to me, your research could change the world. That is an amazing thing to be able to do, because you're looking for something that will not only make really good bread, but is the sustainable wheat that will also taste delicious. That makes you my hero.
There's a lot of things that need to go right for that to be the case, but yeah, you've got to try, haven't you?
That's amazing. So the future, these trials, they take how many years?
For what we see in front of us to turn into the grains that go through a mill to produce the flour that we eat, I would be really surprised if we get that within 20 years. It's a long-term process.
That's quite some commitment.
Yeah. Yeah.
In real terms, against the development of wheat as it happened naturally, you're sort of giving how many thousands of years of development in 20 years?
Well, it's taken 10,000 years to get this far, so
that's not too bad in real terms. So, what for you? What's the most exciting thing that's for you? What really kind of sets you on fire about this project? Because there's a lot of elements looking at it, but what really gets you up in the morning?
I guess the eureka moment so far was the first time we had enough seed of all of these lines to put in the field and have a look at. And I went out and looked at our, we call it a nursery in the field, looked at the nursery with a group of commercial breeders, And they all sort of scratched their heads and said, they actually look quite good. So we were doing some quite wacky and blue sky stuff, and it looked better than anyone expected. That was really exciting.
So do you bake?
Yes, I bake at home, yeah.
That's excellent. I have to ask, because it must be quite interesting to translate it back into bread-making terms.
A colleague of mine has just come up with a wacky idea that we could crowdsource baking tests on some of these. So we could mill some of these varieties into flour and then send them off to interested volunteers to do tests on and send us the feedback.
You can absolutely count me in for that. That is fantastic. Thank you very much for showing me around. It's been truly remarkable. It's, and as a baker, to come right at the other end and see mm-hmm. what's happening to flour and where it's leading, it's incredibly interesting. Thank you.
You're very welcome.